Bitcoin appears to be a decentralized Ponzi scheme, not a decentralized currency. People don't spend it because they want it to go up. The dollar works because of inflation, keeps velocity up like a hot potato. You want store value, silver, gold, and land, because it's beautiful, useful, and valuable. Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme without an individual attached to it to go to prison. So media can control swings for profit. That's my opinion about Bitcoin. The purpose isn't currency. The purpose is to make dollars. The dollar's, quote, weakness is actually why it won't be replaced. Velocity.
The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by Swan.com and CoinKite.com. Swan is the place to buy your Bitcoin and learn about self-custody, and the Cold Card and CoinKite are where you are going to go to get your hardware wallet for that self-custody. Now, I want to share something really quick, both kind of as a disclaimer, but then also because a couple of people have asked me. That voice that you heard at the beginning of the show is the voice of Owen Benjamin, and it is a tweet that Owen Benjamin wrote, but it is my voice acting using an AI to train or to change my voice to Owen Benjamin's, which I trained on about a minute and a half worth of audio from his YouTube channel. So it is not an actual recording of him. And I've been doing this probably in four episodes so far. I've tried not to overdo it, but if there's a lot of text and quotes happening, it's so much easier to be able to distinguish easily between each one if they have consistent voices. You want to learn more about that and the tools that I use, check out AI Unchained, which is my other podcast, and it is also on YouTube. But I just wanted to make that clear since I'm doing that now, and I'll give a little caveat that I'm using AI voices at the beginning of the show when I do. And today we have a great read for you. This one is by Bob Murphy. Now, I don't know if any of you guys know Bob Murphy, if you've been in the libertarian circles and or you follow Tom Woods. Tom Woods was probably one of my first big journeys down the libertarian podcast rabbit hole. I don't even know, 10 years ago. He's been doing it forever. And he and Bob Murphy do tons of stuff together. And I'm a huge fan of Bob Murphy. I also really, really love his book, Choice. But I will say that for a really long time, Tom and Bob had kind of a rough perspective on Bitcoin, which I really think was heavily, heavily influenced by the Bcasher, the big block of crypto camp, because there were a lot of those people in the libertarian space, and it felt like they were always closer to those social circles than the more developer and kind of traditional cypherpunk side. And because they were so disconnected and neither of them were really understood any of the technicals, like the best they had was kind of, you know, the surface layer arguments. And obviously they clearly had a deep understanding of all of the economics because that's what both of them do. So I always try to give them a great benefit of the doubt. And just so you know, if Bob Murphy, Bob, if you end up listening to this, I have a lot of respect for you, and I have invited you on the show a number of times. I know you probably just got lost in the mix, but I would still love to sit down and have a conversation with you. I've been on with Tom twice now, I think, and I could chat with Dave a lot, but you and I have never been able to sit down together and chat about it, and I would love to have a conversation, and I also really enjoyed this piece. And also, just on a more general note, is Bob has, it seems his shift, he has shifted a lot in his take on Bitcoin, which I haven't really been up to date if he has done any writing or posting about Bitcoin. I didn't see it until this very recent back and forth. But I do remember reading a piece by, in fact, did I read it on the show? Maybe I didn't. I don't know. I did remember reading a piece by Murphy long time ago now, a number of years ago, about the Lightning Network being fractional reserve. And that was where it seemed really clear that, you know, the social circles that were kind of giving him explanations were clearly on the I'm mad about the fork camp. Because just from a purely technical standpoint, there's nothing that could be more perfectly verifiably like proof of reserves in the most complete sense, because it's a multi-sig that you are part of, and you can't even sign a transaction without the explicit without the Bitcoin actually being there. Like it, I mean, the idea of it being fractional reserve at all has to be Bob hearing it from people who have no technical understanding, because literally at the protocol level, it is the most complete and localized proof of reserve system that you could essentially design. But I don't mean to preface it with that as like a negative. I just mean that when you read this piece, you'll see that his position on it or his knowledge of it clearly has changed over the years, even if he's not directly interested or kind of going down the rabbit hole. So I actually kind of mean that to be in a compliment in his more nuanced approach and kind of admission for seeing the bigger picture and not really knowing the details or not making a claim one way or the other, and specifically writing a piece about the idea of a sound money, about whether or not a money that appreciates can be a workable system. So no more beating around the bush. Let's go ahead and get into it. Another thank you to Swan and CoinKite for supporting this show. You can find links, discount codes, and a referral link in the show notes to check them out. All right, so let's dive into today's article, and it's titled, Can an Appreciating Bitcoin Be a Good Money? Written by Dr. Robert P. Murphy. One of the recurring questions around Bitcoin is whether it can ever become a widespread money when its purchasing power is expected to increase over time. I have written about such matters with my co-author Silas Barda in this free guide, but it will be helpful to frame the issue in light of a recent Twitter feud between comedian pontificator Owen Benjamin and economist Bitcoin maximalist Saifedean Ammous. Owen Benjamin. Bitcoin appears to be a decentralized Ponzi scheme, not a decentralized currency. People don't spend it because they want it to go up. The dollar works because of inflation. It keeps velocity up like a hot potato. If you want to store value, silver, gold, and land, because it's beautiful, useful, and valuable. Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme without an individual attached to it to go to prison, so the media can control swings for profit. That's my opinion about Bitcoin. The purpose isn't currency. The purpose is to make dollars. The dollar's, quote, weakness is actually why it won't be replaced. Velocity. Saifedean. The dollar works in spite of inflation, not because of it. Like a leaky bucket will have to do when you have no alternative. Inflation is just necessary to rob you, not to make your money work. Velocity is a meaningless, irrelevant concept from scam Keynesian economics. What gets used as money is whatever has the biggest cash balances, the most saleable commodity, and that's whatever is the hardest to make. Historically, this was gold and silver, but now it's Bitcoin because it's even harder. Read my books, The Bitcoin Standard and The Fiat Standard, if you want the full explanation in layman's terms. You can pirate them from libgen.rs. Owen Benjamin. No, people spend the weakest currency. It's called currency velocity. People don't use Bitcoin and measure it in dollars after a decade. Do what you want, dude, but it's not a currency. Inflation is people spending dollars on businesses and other stores of value. It's why it's king. Really, think about it. I know you're all in on Bitcoin, but it really doesn't make sense. Totally. It's gibberish. Bitcoin saved my family. A currency is what you use to buy and sell. Bitcoin isn't that. No one accepts it and you don't pay taxes with it. So fiat is a superior currency. A store of wealth is in a business, land, tools, metal, commodities. Bitcoin is a speculation merry-go-round that people treat as a religion. Bitcoin isn't money. At least yet. Like a good economist, I will give a two-handed reaction to the above exchange, which I have edited for space constraints. They each said more, of course. On the other hand, I agree with Owen that right now, Bitcoin is not money. I use the standard definition of these terms as codified in the work of Ludwig von Mises, and as such, Bitcoin is clearly a medium of exchange, meaning that some people right now accept Bitcoin in trade not because they want to directly consume it or even to use it to produce something else, but solely to hold it with the purpose of selling it in the future. But for a good to be classified as money, it must be a medium of exchange that is generally accepted in the community. On this criterion, I don't think Bitcoin has yet passed the threshold, and as such, I don't think it yet qualifies as genuine money, though it might one day in the future. A good money maintains its purchasing power. On the other hand, I agree with Saifedean that its inflationary aspect is a weakness of the US dollar. The reason the dollar became the global reserve currency is that it historically had been a relatively secure store of value, by which we simply mean that it maintains its purchasing power or exchange rate vis-a-vis other goods and services over time. There is a long and nuanced history of the US dollar's ties to gold and silver, which I briefly outline in a chapter in this online book, link provided. Suffice it to say, the dollar achieved its vaulted status not because it was always bleeding away its purchasing power, but rather because it was a relatively dependable currency that maintained its exchange value. In the real world, when a country is racked by hyperinflation, the citizens will abandon their domestic currency and either revert to barter or they will conduct their transactions with a foreign currency. When making such a switch, they obviously don't import a currency that has a 40% inflation rate. That's the very type of disaster they're trying to escape. Unpacking Gresham's Law. There's a famous aphorism in economics called Gresham's Law, which states that bad money drives out good. That seems to be what's driving Owen's comments quoted above. However, this observation doesn't mean that given a free choice, consumers will embrace bad money. That would be as nonsensical as claiming that bad hamburgers drive out good or bad computers drive out good. In every other area of commerce, we expect people to prefer good products over bad ones. No, what Gresham's Law referred to was a situation in which the government had enacted price controls and/or legal tender laws, which forced merchants to accept a certain money with a purchasing power that deviated from what the actual market equilibrium would have yielded. For example, during the early days of the U.S. Republic, the official monetary policy was one of bimetallism, in which people could take raw gold or silver and have them stamped into official coins of particular denominations of U.S. dollars. Because the very definition of a U.S. dollar was stated in grains of gold or grains of silver, the government was effectively setting a price control, especially in conjunction with a legal system that would recognize certain items as being valid legal tender for the payment of debts. In such an environment, when the actual market price of gold versus silver moved above or below the ratio that the U.S. government policy had implicitly enshrined by law with its twofold definition of the dollar, it would give people an incentive to hoard one type of coin and spend the other. In other words, all of the merchants were charging in terms of dollars and cents, so if the governments then dictated how much gold or how much silver somebody had to come up with to qualify as dollars or cents, people would naturally use the cheaper metal in terms of the international market prices of them when making their purchases. For a modern analogy, consider, suppose you want to buy something at the store that costs $1. You put your hand in your pocket and pull out 5 quarters. 4 of the quarters were minted after the year 2000, but you look closely and realize that one of the quarters was minted in 1940, back when a quarter was 90% silver. Depending on the spot price of silver, that means a 1940 quarter is worth at least $5 and possibly much more if it's in good condition and might appeal to collectors. In this situation, you would be foolish to use your 1940 quarter in the transaction, where it would only be valued at the official legal tender price of 25 cents. So, you would hoard that, quote, good quarter and spend the 4, quote, bad quarters to buy the item marked at $1. Everybody else in the community is doing the same thing, and so people would conclude that Americans only use bad quarters as their money, which had driven out the, quote, good quarters from circulation. So this is the pattern that Gresham's law is describing. But again, notice how particular this outcome is. It depends on the fact that we are all, in the United States, using U.S. currency as defined by the authorities, and where someone can pay a debt denominated in dollars with quarters minted in the year 2000, even though they have no silver content. Bitcoin can be a good money. As Saifedean stresses in his work, the fact that the total supply of bitcoins is ultimately capped at 21 million is a reason to favor it, in contrast to government-issued fiat currencies that can be doubled overnight by political whim. We can imagine a scenario where everyone in society uses a money that is fixed in quantity, and therefore tends to gently appreciate year after year as the output of real, quote-unquote, goods and services continues to increase. In this framework, you would see the price of haircuts and hamburgers, quoted in Satoshis, falling, say, 3% annually. Contrary to Owen's perspective, this pattern would not cripple the economy. Once people had adjusted to this pattern, interest rates and other prices would adjust. Right now, the price of buying 1 megabyte of computer RAM drops even when measured in US dollars, but that doesn't paralyze computer sales. It's true, if we're starting off in a position when nobody wants to spend their bitcoins because they're holding them for speculative purposes, then it's not suitable as a generally accepted medium of exchange. But that's simply describing what happens in a transition period, as the purchasing power of Bitcoin rises to the level that its fundamentals, in terms of serving its role as a facilitator of trades, suggest. For those interested in more details on how this process of hodling leading to widespread adoption and then unloading could unfold, I refer you to this episode of my podcast. The links will be provided in the show notes. Finally, I want to stress that I am not here predicting that Bitcoin, with or without augmentation from something like the Lightning Network, will one day become the money of planet Earth. Instead, I am just trying to clarify the dispute that Owen and Saifedean had on Twitter to give the economic framework in which to interpret their claims. If you are looking to buy Bitcoin, if you were looking to buy Bitcoin regularly for a long-term savings account, if you're looking for a place to learn about self-custody, if you want to figure out how to quickly and easily allocate into your IRA and have Bitcoin in your retirement account, if you want to get your business allocated to use Bitcoin in your business treasury and to offer employee benefit plans, or you want to work with a financial advisor on how to best manage your Bitcoin allocation, you want to know about inheritance planning and estate planning, the best strategy on tax loss harvesting, and you want to do all this in one platform without having to spread yourself out and sign up for 100 different things, and you want low fees and free withdrawals, Swan Bitcoin has the entire suite. I've personally been using them for a really long time. I highly suggest taking advantage of their automatic withdrawals. It is one of the best things to just know that you have Bitcoin in your custody and that you don't have to do anything complex or manage it. You just punch in an address and they will send it to you every time it hits your threshold or every time you make a purchase. I personally recommend a threshold for that sweet UTXO management, but to each his own. There's some episodes about it if you're interested in kind of diving a little bit deeper. SwanBitcoin.com/guy is my link if you want to check them out, and you will find it right in the show notes. Again, that is SwanBitcoin.com/guy for a financial suite of services to allocate, invest, and learn about Bitcoin. Sometimes I'm just amazed at how persistent some ideas are and how unbelievably confidently people claim or just broadcast something that is the most basic, most repetitive, mainstream talking point that has no fundamental, like no logical foundation. Like the idea that a money works because it doesn't hold value, when everything about the concept of money is the fact that it is the thing that holds value better than any other item. Like that's its entire purpose. It isn't consumed in any manufacturing process. It isn't used to produce sandwiches or shirts. It is exclusively and entirely meant to transmit value from Monday to Friday. and its entire existence is predicated upon the fact that everything else sucks at doing that. You can't do that with a turkey sandwich. It's disgusting on Wednesday. And to be so painfully wrong about every competition between separate monies since the beginning of time. Even among fiat currencies, the reason the dollar is quote-unquote king is because it has the least inflation. The reason Argentina and Zimbabwe and Yemen and all of these countries that are having currency crises and huge devaluations and capital controls, the reason they run to the dollar is because the dollar inflates less. The dollar is literally the least inflation currency on a giant pile of crap. So right out the gate, Owen's main point that the dollar works because it is increasingly weak is negated by the very reason why the dollar is the most successful, which is partially circular, but is dependent upon the history, which Bob Murphy specifically points out in this. I mean, doesn't, you know, elaborate on it a ton, but, you know, it's a whole piece in and of itself. Is the whole reason for for the dollar's success and historical strength was because it was backed by gold. And in fact, through multiple eras and major world wars, it maintained the closest semblance of exactly that, of being scarce and actually being redeemable for gold, which is why it became the world reserve currency to begin with. Is because there was the least capital and productive destruction in the United States during World War II, and then its competition with the British pound before it officially, more officially, became the global reserve currency. I think it was like towards the late 50s, early 60s. And the reason for that had nothing to do with the fact that it had better velocity. To the contrary, it was because it was the one most confidently backed by gold and most confidently backed by actual productivity to steal from in order to pay the debt. Not to mention that the debt levels were actually relatively stable. They were still pretty much growing aside from the massive correction that happened after World War II, but they were very, very calmly growing. And there were like four periods, I think, during that zone in which we actually ran a surplus. It wasn't uncommon because we weren't fiscally retarded like we are today. So if there was any truth whatsoever to the fact that the dollar works and it's the best because of inflation, it would literally be the worst of the currencies because it's the one that's inflated the least. Everybody would have a better economy than the U.S., because they would all have great velocity. But Seyfedin is totally right here. There's no easier way to put it. Velocity is a meaningless, irrelevant concept from scam Keynesian economics. It does nothing to meaningfully inform the growth or quality of the economic position. You can have aggressively high velocity and a crap, awful economy, and you can have low velocity and a great, robust economy. It doesn't mean anything. It is a loose, back-splained correlation that at best correlates in the sense that if you produce a lot of debt out of thin air and encourage a bunch of fake economic activity, it appears like there is growth until you actually have to pay for that debt. Going back to the example I use many times, if you only have 10 houses worth of wood to build houses and you issue debt for 20 houses, it looks like you have a lot more velocity because you have a lot more people working when you start building 20 houses, but you can't build 20 houses with 10 houses worth of wood. It is not real growth, and the velocity has nothing to do with the fact that there is a prosperous or non-prosperous economic activity going on. It is entirely related to whether or not the activity is sustainable. The velocity does not tell you whether it is or is not. Another great and comically accurate portrayal of this ridiculous notion is the joke about the two economists walking down the sidewalk, and one of them, as they continue walking, they're walking down the sidewalk in San Francisco, because this is what makes it believable. They're in San Francisco, they're walking down the sidewalk, and they come across a big pile of feces on the sidewalk. One economist says to the other, I'll pay you $100 to eat that poop. And he does so. And then they continue walking and they run into another big pile of poop. And the other economist, the one who ate the poop, says, well, I'll pay you $100 to eat that poop. And he says, all right, I'll take it. And they both have eaten poop and they both exchange $100. And realizing that they're in the exact same situation they started in, but both of them have eaten poop, one of the economists stops and says, I feel like that was all for nothing. And the other economist says, ah, but we added $200 to GDP. Also important to note, they have a far higher monetary velocity than if they had just stepped over the poop like sane human beings. Now, going back to his other point of Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme. I know people feel smart when they say this, but I have just come to the conclusion that nobody understands what the hell a Ponzi scheme is. A Ponzi scheme is something that appears to make a profit that is insolvent, that is paying out the early people who have put money in with the money that the new people are putting in. Not that they're trading with them, that the total amount of money isn't actually there, that the profits are fake. There's no actual capital being accumulated, no value being accumulated, and no productivity being made to actually have any sort of a payout. They are insolvent, and they are just taking new investors' money and directly porting it to the old investors who are getting paid quote-unquote shares or profit of the scheme. There is literally nothing about Bitcoin that has anything whatsoever to do with this structure of a scam. What's so ironic about this is that the dollar system and the fractional reserve banking system is actually a Ponzi scheme. There is no way to pay for all of the interest. There is no way to actually sustain the value of anything in the economy if we are not issuing more debt. The banks are literally insolvent. Go look at the unrealized losses on balance sheets. The only reason any of this stuff is surviving is specifically because the government has just, again, in the numerous myriad ways that they cook the books, they've just come up with another way to cook the books, and they're guaranteeing loans and the value of these bonds at rates that have nothing to do with the market rate. And then they're allowing these same institutions, these same banks, to borrow against a rate that is completely made up. Why? Because if they don't borrow more, the whole thing implodes. It's a Ponzi scheme. If there's no new money being created, the whole thing collapses in on itself. Now, you could argue a bunch of nuance that, you know, there's not the entirety of the direct structure of the Ponzi scheme, because it's the difference between bonds and the actual currency and blah, 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 nuance, fine. But the dollar absolutely has far more of the characteristics and direct problems of a Ponzi scheme than Bitcoin does. There's nothing. Bitcoin is literally just an asset. The entire argument for saying that Bitcoin is a Ponzi scheme is just that he doesn't think it's worth what it's worth. Which is totally fine for someone to think that it's not actually valuable because they don't know anything about it. I'm not going to complain about that. I'm not going to call somebody stupid about that. People have different opinions, and the knowledge gaps all over the place are massive. That is completely reasonable. But because you don't think something is worth something doesn't make it a Ponzi scheme. Selling pet rocks isn't a Ponzi scheme, even though I think it's stupid. But if Owen has an opinion that Bitcoin isn't worth anything, then all right, don't invest in it. Don't buy any of it. But you know, I guess, oh God, it's just so frustrating. Like, and I get where his information circles come from, like that he has just no idea what's going on. Like, it's so clear that he, you know, probably has read a couple of articles about people who also have never used or have no idea what's going on in Bitcoin. Like this line, the purpose isn't currency, the purpose is to make dollars. That is not true for any Bitcoiner I know. Like nobody, I'm myself, just being as an example, the fuck I want any dollars. I don't want any dollars. Dollars are garbage. They're the worst possible thing to hold. Why would I take quote unquote profit in something crappier than Bitcoin? Why the hell would I ever want to keep something that is always losing value? I do not take profit in dollars. I enter and exit dollars for the shortest possible time in which I need the dollar network to make trades. That is it. I use dollars solely for the dollar network, not for its monetary value whatsoever. I am on a Bitcoin standard. Everything that is not in dollars for the immediate purpose of paying bills, and every bill that I can't pay directly in Bitcoin, which I can with numerous things and do, Bitcoin is my main currency. I use it more than the dollar. I have no interest in quote-unquote taking profit in dollars. For the exact same reason, if I had a stash of diamonds that were going up in value relative to dirt, that I would ever get really excited about finally selling my diamonds for a giant pile of dirt. Because what do you know? This year I can get twice the amount of dirt as I could get last year for all my diamonds. Just because of the articles that he read or his finance bro friends that are all just trading, that are just gambling on Bitcoin because that's what the whole stock market has become. The entire financial sector is just a bunch of degenerate gamblers. Why? Because of the dollar's inflation. Because the dollar fails to do the one job that it's supposed to do. That's one thing that people just, it's mind-blowing to me. You know, he says, actually, I think he actually brings this up. Where is this? Yeah, so his second post in response to Saifedean, or one of the posts, says, no, people spend the weakest currency. It's called currency velocity. People don't use Bitcoin and measure it in dollars after a decade. Do what you want, dude, but it's not a currency. Inflation is people spend dollars on businesses and other stores of value. This is where this mainstream platitude of inflation encourages investment is really funny, because we actually see all the mainstream complains endlessly about all of the consequences of this without realizing that we're being explained over and over again that this is exactly what happens. Do you know what inflation does? It disconnects the information in the money that allows us to compare one investment to another properly. Think about it. If you have two different markets, there's a market for cars and there's a market for scooters. The reason we can price cars in scooters is because the money that is used in relation to cars and the money that is used in relation to scooters is the same. It is a single monetary unit that is consistent throughout the economic system. If someone prints millions or billions of dollars and shoves it through the scooter industry, they issue it exclusively in a bunch of loans to encourage people to buy scooters. Now the price of scooters relative to cars has nothing to do with the economic reality or the reality on the ground with how people are actually valuing those things, because money is different in relation to scooters than it is to cars. It doesn't encourage investment. It encourages stupid decisions based on misinformation. And suddenly you have a flurry of investment in scooters when nobody actually wants them. And this happens across the board. This is why the financial markets are absurd. This is why the VC funding market has become a bloated, gambling, speculative disaster, is because we constantly inflate the currency, we constantly issue new loans, and we specifically push it through the financial sector so that they are literally, they're just standing under a giant spigot with trillions of dollars of falling out of it, and they have no idea what the price of anything is according to any real value, and it's shooting up the prices of all commodities and actually stable and scarce goods that people actually need to survive, and it's monetizing them. It's making people buy up houses off the market just to park value when people actually need them to live inside of. The fact that the price of housing keeps skyrocketing and we have a homeless problem are not separate from each other. They are consequences of each other. The money spigot flows into the economy and housing prices skyrocket because they're a more stable, real estate is a stable, scarce asset, the thing that money is actually supposed to be, and the people who don't even want the house will buy it just because in a couple of years it's going to be worth more. Check that. It's not worth anymore. It's going to be a higher price. Two of the critical characteristics of money, which we have well established over the entire history of monetary history, are that it is durable and scarce. Inflation is a negative in both categories. The reason we use money is because everything else degrades. The value of a sandwich, like I said, degrades very quickly. The value of a chicken degrades very quickly. The value of a car degrades very quickly. Therefore, if we tried to use these things in trade, it would make no sense. It would not allow us to make long-term investment decisions and long-term contracts. And if they ever maintained, if they ever grew into having a monetary premium, we would just make a crap ton more of them. They're too easy to make. And the premium would be essentially printed away, and then its use in storing value would just fall away. It would go right back to its utility value. The reason a perfectly static monetary good is actually a crucial and incredibly information-dense mechanism or tool to use as money is because the natural deflation that occurs in that money will accurately predict the changing value of your investment. Your investment might be worth something today at today's prices, but if in 5 years we expect prices to be 20% lower across the board, then you sure as hell better not be making an investment over a 5-year timeline in something that doesn't have a 20% return. It's not worth it. And you don't know unless the currency is actually exchanging, is actually transmitting that information into the market. Murphy brings up a really good point, and it's something in, I think it's Kyle Ward's piece that we read on the show of It's like the deflation of TVs, or the horrible deflation of TVs or something. I can't remember exactly what it's called. I'll remember to put that link in the show notes if you want to listen to that episode. I highly recommend it. It's a good article, and I have a lengthy guy's take on it afterward. But Murphy specifically brings that up with computers and electronics, is that it doesn't seem to slow down that sector at all, that megabytes of a hard drive are worth, you know, how much less, that even in the face of the dollar, they decline in price. And yet it does not prevent anyone from investing in storage. It is incredible how so fundamentally backwards this perception is, and that it's entirely based off a fiat problem of issuing way more debt than you can handle and then experiencing a massive deflationary crisis in the evisceration of debts that were unsustainable. That's got nothing to do with sound money. To the contrary, it's a problem of unsound money causing a debt imbalance. But natural deflation is an entirely different thing, and we see it everywhere. The entire tech sector is a perfect example of what natural deflation looks like. Deflation that is so intense that even in the 7% annual increase in the M2 money supply of the dollar, it still deflates in price. That is incredible. But what I mean when I say it's a complete reversal of, like, just a complete backwards thinking about why this even occurs, is that natural deflation occurs because of productivity growth. Not, it doesn't cause it. It doesn't hinder it. It happens because the growth happened already. This is basic supply and demand and order of operations. If you just think about it chronologically, if you have X amount of supply and X amount of demand, and you increase the supply 2X, and thus price of those things fall, that's deflation in the currency. When you have this across the board in the productivity and supply of all of the goods and services that you need, that they are cheaper and easier to make across the board. But the price only comes down because the price is bid down after the growth occurs. Like, how is this not obvious? Prices are lagging indicators. They respond to events that have occurred. They respond to the change of a bid and an ask on the market. If the price of 44-inch 1080p TVs gets cuts in half, it's an indication for people to stop making 44-inch 1080p and maybe make 50-inch 4K TVs. Aggressively inflating the currency so that you have 2% inflation in the price of 44-inch 1080p TVs is just going to make a bunch of VC idiots think that it's smart to invest in 44-inch 1080p TVs for a decade in which they're already obsolete. It just props up stupid investments. It does not encourage investments. It makes investment an idiotic endeavor that cannot price things accurately. It makes shit that is wasteful and destructive of value and critical scarce resources look profitable. It's a lie. It fuels stupidity, gambling, speculation, and consumerism. All of these things that the same morons who say we have to have an inflated currency to encourage investment look at the consequences of artificially stimulating investment and a whole bunch of people just blindly pull money out of their ass and throw it at the stock market and all the prices go up and everybody's a gambler and everybody's like, none of this even makes sense. P&E ratios are absolute nonsense. Everything's like 3x, 5x what it used to be in a sensible market 40 years ago. There's debt and leverage to an ungodly amount all across the board. Our banking systems are insolvent and the finance VC bros in the stock market can't even tell you what they're investing in. They just blindly throw at anything with green candles. And while the economy is in shambles and people are straining to afford normal things, GDP is going up and all the metrics look great and that velocity's doing real good right now. All the metrics just become nonsense. They're just massive avalanche of noise and bullshit floods into the economic system, because if you have 7% inflation, then something that is actually losing 5% in value looks like a 2% nominal profit. Think about the idiocy of that. If you have 7% inflation and you have something that is losing 5% real value, it will appear to have 2% profit at the end of the year. A static money supply will tell you, don't invest in that, that's dumb. An inflated money supply will get tons of people to throw money at it and waste resources that are precious, that are scarce and needed for other things. And understand, money isn't one of those resources. If you had an infinitely divisible monetary unit, it wouldn't matter if we had $1 trillion, $1 quadrillion, or $100 in circulation. The value would simply adjust so that you could just divide it up into smaller or use it in bigger units, and it would continue to operate as long as it didn't aggressively fluctuate in supply. If someone is saving money for an extended period of time, they take access to no resources is taken from anyone else. People do not need the money. They need the resource. And what happens is the resource actually goes down in price if money is taken off the market. And to take money off the market and not use it to buy stuff is explicitly done by removing your demand from the market, leaving the supply of real goods and services available in the market. Think about it. It's so dirt simple. If there are 10 people, 9 of them really need a house, and one of them just thinks it might be good to buy a house because it'll go up in price. They're not going to use it. They're just going to sit on it. If it turns out that they do the math and the house isn't actually going to appreciate very much, and the money itself might actually appreciate by like 5% in a year or two, then they won't invest in the house. They won't buy the house. Now imagine there's 9 houses on the market. There are 10 people chasing houses. 9 of them need those houses to live in. That 10th person, if the house is just going to arbitrarily go up in price because a whole bunch of money is being printed, the 10th person is going to buy the house and they're going to outbid everybody else because they want to outbid it specifically so that they can grow their dollar supply. They want to make a nominal return on the investment, and it is explicitly at the cost of someone who needs it to live in. When that person takes their money off the market, when they save the money, what they have done is they have left the house for the people who actually need it. Saving money is a good for the market. It is the most important thing for making a robust and resilient market, in fact. And again, common sense makes this blatantly true. Think about it. When is the easy route where you get everything you want? When is that actually the one that's good for everyone? That not being prudent, going into debt, just buying whatever you want whenever you think about it, that's the one that's quote-unquote good for the economy. But if you save money, you're hoarding it and you're bad for the economy. Saving money is the hard thing. Saving money is the one that requires responsibility and frugality, and to actually care about where your money goes and be thoughtful about where your resources are being spent. But somehow being irresponsible, frivolous, and thoughtless is the one that's quote-unquote good for the economy? Take it a step back. What is savings and what is debt? Just think about it from the context of a single person. You make 10 sandwiches and you eat 10 sandwiches. You have no surplus, you have no debt, right? You're a net neutral for the economy. Now let's say you make 20 sandwiches and you only eat 10, and what you make from the other 10 sandwiches, you save. You fed 10 people. You have provided 10 meals to other people, and you have not requested those resources back out of the economy. You have done a net good. Now you eat 20 meals and you only make 10. You have stolen 10 meals from other people at the promise that you would pay it back. But their ability to eat is reliant on you actually running a surplus one day. A debt is a destruction of resources that you promise to pay back. A surplus is a net creation of resources. If you just spread this out across everyone in society, how could you possibly, with 5 warm brain cells at least, make the ridiculous argument that everyone destroying more resources than they create is good for the economy because it means higher velocity? No, it doesn't. It means we destroyed more shit than we made, and everything's going to fall apart if we don't get our asses into gear and actually fulfill our promises.
The thing that gets me worked up more than anything else is the end of this line. It says, inflation is people spend dollars on businesses and other stores of value. That's why it's king. Like, as if people buying and storing a bunch of gold and silver and houses and stuff, why the hell would that be? Like, when if we lost the utter basic common sense that more productivity and more resources and more stability and robustness in every single individual situation, everybody had more leisure time, if everybody had more savings, if everybody was in a stronger position, that is a good economy. That's what a good economy is. And it doesn't matter if it has less velocity, because all it has to do is be more meaningful in the ways that it invests. You could have 10 times the velocity and 10 times the investment in dumb, awful crap, and people literally picking up poop off of the sidewalk and eating it. You could have a giant multi-trillion dollar market of people eating shit and watching each other do it. And everyone going into debt and leveraging to gamble on this giant and incredibly stupid game of speculation. You would have all the numbers that you would, that this normal Keynesian or statist would think you would need to have, just the biggest possible numbers. You'd have high employment, lots of people eating poop, you have high GDP, you have high velocity, you have high investment, you have high returns. None of it has anything to do with prosperity or a healthy, robust economy. This always running at a million miles an hour, never getting a break, never getting leisure time, never living paycheck to paycheck, always trying desperately to get a 10-20% raise just to catch up with things. This is not the natural state of things. This is not a healthy economy. This is a panicked, fragile economy that is leveraged up to their eyeballs, and where 80% of the entire country cannot afford a single $2,000 unexpected cost. That is an F on the report card of economic security. D minus at best. It is so weak, in fact, that it cannot make it a year without one of enormous amount of money printing, another fraud scheme to guarantee prices that aren't real, or another giant batch of loan issuance, or another bank bailout, and all the different colors and packages that those come in. And then after Owen shares the most inane, endlessly regurgitated, same empty platitudes of the political economists that have made this ridiculous economy what it is and fueled the most glorious debt bubble in the history of mankind, he says, really think about it. Think about it. Think about it as if there's some deep analysis that he's gone through to come to the conclusion of all the mainstream idiocy that has produced the current conditions that we are living under. But no one's ever heard of those. Nobody's ever heard that argument before. Inflation is good? Well, this is news. I should really think about this new and unique revelation. You know, one thing that's funny about this is how interesting it is. Kind of like just evil and kind of poisonous too, but interesting nonetheless, that the political sphere has convinced us that what is bad for us individually is good for us collectively, and what is good for us individually is bad for us collectively. That there is this huge incentive misalignment between the individual and the society. And literally outside of the commons problem, that's not even remotely the case. A healthy society, a healthy collective, is literally just a bunch of healthy individuals. That's it. There's no separation between those things. The collective is just a bunch of individuals. If you have a bunch of individuals that are weak, that are leveraged, that have no time to themselves, they have no leisure, they have no savings in order to turn down an unethical job or to not do something abusive or immoral that their boss demands of them, or they don't have enough money to make it through a bad week or a storm that breaks something that they're relying on, they don't have any savings, they have to go into debt, they have to leverage themselves further, that their life is insanely fragile, none of that. There's nothing about that that's good for the entire society. And every additional individual that finds themselves in that situation is additionally bad for the entire collective. It's a horrible situation. The entirety of whether or not the collective is healthy is based on whether or not the individuals are healthy. This entire myth that they are somehow at odds when all society is a bunch of individuals is insane. We have allowed ourselves to accept that debt is somehow actually a surplus when you really think about it. That losing money is actually good for you if you really think about it. That someone else counterfeiting your currency to the tune of trillions of dollars every year is actually really good for you. Think about it. That people just blindly investing in things who have no business investing and don't have the slightest clue how to actually intelligently measure or make sense of an investment, but is doing so specifically because they just need to run away from the dollar, that's actually a good thing. Think about it. Savings and actually having a buffer and actually being able to secure and the optionality to make decisions and pick your job and being robust in your economic standing, that's actually bad. Think about it. And then if your money was actually valuable, people wouldn't waste it. And that's bad. Think about it. And on that one, Bob Murphy does a really good job, actually, in this piece on the whole Gresham's Law thing, is that Gresham's Law is not a natural phenomenon in the sense that if you have two competing things in an open market, I love this quote, this is a great section, it says, however, this observation doesn't mean that given a free choice, consumers will embrace bad money. That would be as nonsensical as claiming that bad hamburgers drive out good, or bad computers drive out good. In every other area of commerce, we expect people to prefer good products over bad ones. And what is actually happening when we think about Gresham's Law and when we think about Owen's quote-unquote complaint or claim as to why Bitcoin won't work is the idea that people aren't spending Bitcoin is because their money is good for two things. Money has two explicit purposes, to store value and to trade. So it's to store value that you created that is going to degrade and is hard to break up or granularize. You know, we're talking about divisibility, durability, that other people can make a whole lot more of. So it's not scarce. All the things that we do, the services, the sandwiches, the shirts, the houses, all the things that do not have those characteristics, we exchange them for something that does have those characteristics so that it holds value. Because the problem with all of those things is that they don't hold value. That's why you need money. In order to exchange value across space and across time, the most critical and important first step is to hold it during the time in which you are moving across space or waiting for a new time.
holding value is a prerequisite to being used to exchange value. So what's happening when you have this bad money drives out good is that you divorce both of those, both things actually stop working very well as money. One of them becomes the medium of exchange and the other one becomes the store of value. So what you have is two monies that are serving the different role, the different relative roles that they are best at. And it's specifically because one is required. You are forced to accept one in spending. Therefore, it is, if it is specifically bad money, then that's the one you will always want to spend. So in other words, the reason it drives out the good is because people want the good. Money both comes in and out. It is the thing that is never consumed. It is always in circulation. To when it comes in, you are actually valuing the money positively. You believe the money is a good thing that is going to keep your value better than all of the things that you could hold otherwise. When you are spending the money, you are explicitly saying that the goods and the services you can get for it are now more valuable than the money. In other words, you don't think it's good money. You don't think it's going to do what it's supposed to do for you. You're selling it. Just like every other thing that you sell because you don't want it anymore, and you buy it because you do want it. You buy the high value thing, you sell the low value thing. The bad money drives out good phenomenon is explicitly a move by the market to say, I want this one because it's good, and I don't want this one anymore because it's bad. The two major differences in the dynamic is that money isn't consumed, so you simply don't run out of the bad thing that you're trying to get rid of, and you have a government monopoly and enforce coercive behavior where everyone is forced to accept it. They just make it perpetual that you can never actually fully get rid of the bad thing. But there is nothing about that that suggests that the dollar is better. Everything about it is suggesting that everyone in the market is doing exactly the opposite. They are indicating in every meaningful market sense that it is the shitty one and they are buying a better one. And if you continue to accept a crappy one, that is the one they will give you because they don't want to let the other one go. Because that one actually does its job. All right. Anyway, I thought that was a great article. And I appreciate Bob Murphy's more nuanced and, you know, not very aggressive take on it, unlike mine can often be. I highly encourage you to follow Bob Murphy. Like I said, longtime fan and a lot of respect for him. And his book Choice is really good. It's essentially a human action in understandable language. So I actually recommend, or I like recommending that one a lot just because it's a whole lot easier than, you know, the traditional Austrian economists and, you know, human action is just it's a beast. It's brilliant, but it is a beast and it's very hard to digest for a lot of people. Choice is a much easier place to start. And kudos to Bob Murphy for writing that one. I'll have the link to that in the show notes. And also, I don't mean to be so hard on Owen Benjamin here. Granted, I don't really know much. I've heard the name and I kind of know of his existence, but you know, people are opinions and knowledge is entirely built upon access, you know, and the information asymmetries, particularly in money and Bitcoin, are shocking. They're incredible. So despite my frustration and my tendency to get really passionate about it, I try not to be too judgmental about the information asymmetries that exist, because they are impossible to avoid. And I want to extend another invite. I would love to have Bob Murphy on the show to talk about all of this stuff. I hope he actually listens to this and is still around here at the end of the show. But please feel free to DM me. In fact, I'll probably, after I post this on Twitter, I'll probably DM you and invite you on the show again. And I would love to have a long conversation about money and economics, because I really love to geek out on that stuff. All right, I'll have the article in the show notes and the link to his Twitter so that you can follow him. Don't forget to check out and thank our amazing sponsors, Swan and CoinKite. All of those details will also be in the show notes, and they support and make this show possible, and I cannot thank them enough for that. Also, everyone, a free and easy way to help out the show. Obviously, you can boost on Fountain. If you're not using the Fountain app, at fountain.fm, by the way, I am in love with the new interface. It's, again, hats off. But you can boost on Fountain.
share it out, and also leave a review. Leaving a review anywhere is great for the metrics or for the attention. It knocks it up in the rankings, and it gets the show in front of more people. So it's a really easy and free way for you to help out the show. All right. Thank you all so much for listening. I will catch you next week. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Production is quite possible without money. There is no need for money, either in the isolated household or in the socialized community. Nowhere can we discover a good of the first order of which we could say that the use of money was a necessary condition of its production. Ludwig von Mises, The Theory of Money and Credit.